This is CISO to CISO, a live podcast focusing on information security, leadership, innovation, and more. Brought to you by Altitude Networks, data security for the cloud. Welcome, everyone. My name is Michael Coates. This is another edition of our CISO to CISO webcast. I'm super excited. I'm joined today with Flea. So we're going to have a great conversation about a lot of things. This webcast is brought to you by Altitude Networks. We are a cloud-native DLP solution provider. So if you're using platforms like G Suite, Box, and others in the cloud, we are that system that are finding data and protecting it. Sensitive data like board decks, salary information, privileged legal documents, any of those things that you don't want shared in the wrong way, from accidents, off-boarded employees, malicious contractors, rogue apps, you name it. So if that's interesting to you, check us out at altitudenetworks.com or at the link below of this recording. So with that said, let's dive in. Flea, so happy to have you here. You have been in amazing places. You're the CISO of Gusto. You've been the head of InfoSec at Square. You've been director of security at NetSuite, and then more and more and more. Thanks for taking some time out to talk with us.
No, thanks for having me here. You know, I've always been a big fan. It's always great to get a chance to chat to a CISO neighbor. I love the fact that, you know, you're at Twitter and literally like right across the street from me at Square. Huge fan. Got to follow your work super early and just really appreciate a lot of stuff you've been doing.
Oh, thank you. Thank you much. Yeah, and for those of you that are looking at the video, you might notice we are in this wonderful bar location. Our webcasts are now virtual on location. I wish we were actually here, but Flea, tell us a little bit about where we are. I always like to let the guest pick somewhere in the world that's interesting to them.
Yes, so this bar is Dry Martini. It's actually a phenomenal cocktail bar in Barcelona. It's actually one of my favorite places. And one of the great things about it, if you actually go to this bar, like obviously their specialty is martinis, and it's a whole ritual behind the martini, the way they serve it to you, the way it's prepared, et cetera. In fact, the gentleman that's actually in the mirror behind you, he's actually still at that bar making martinis. He actually made several martinis for me. And you can actually go there, and when you get served a martini, they actually give you a certificate for the martini when you were served it. And when you go back to the bar, you can effectively just get extra stamps, et cetera. So it becomes like a whole ordeal. I love Barcelona. I love this bar. I have so many great memories of this bar. And actually are memories. I didn't, you know, overdrink. So it's just a phenomenal place. Highly recommended. And I got the recommendation from a couple of other just great security practitioners. So, you know, Dr. Gary McGraw, you know, Sigital, and also, you know, Dr. Matthias Madu, you know, they're huge cocktail fans as well. And both of them actually recommended this for.
Very cool. Well, awesome. So your journey in security, like I mentioned before, you've been at some amazing places and you started off towards the beginning in a developer role.
Yes.
Tell us about that journey. How did you end up as a CISO of Gusto? Did you know you always wanted to be in that role? How did you make that big leap?
Oh, that is a great question. So you're exactly right. I actually started my professional career as a developer. And part of that actually, you know, I originally went to school for electrical engineering. You know, at the time, it seemed to be like the path. You know, as you can probably see from the gray hair, I'm a little bit older than maybe some other people here in Silicon Valley. And so when I was actually beginning my journey, just in general, there really wasn't a security industry in the same way actually thinking about it today. And so if you wanted to actually get into computer science, those kind of things, you generally just follow the normal path of being an engineer. I'm actually super grateful for that because I believe that that's part of my superpowers, my ability to actually write code, to understand code, but even more so to understand the value of building. So, you know, I, you know, started my career at a couple of like really, really small startups, believe it or not, startups even in Oklahoma. So yes, the Midwest does have a tech scene, phenomenal tech scene. And then from there, I went on to join Bank of America. And this is actually right after the dot-com crash. When I was at Bank of America, actually I joined Bank of America as a developer, once again, primarily focused on authentication and authorization systems, a lot of stuff around like certificate management, cryptography and things like that. At the time, this is once again super early in what we think of now as the AppSec industry, Bank of America didn't have an application security team. And being a curious developer and you know, just curious about security in general. I found some interesting ways at Bank of America to essentially give myself a pay raise and everybody else a pay raise. So when I found that, I thought, okay, I'm probably gonna get fired for this. But being a Boy Scout, I was like, yep, I gotta admit this anyway. I need to actually tell somebody, because actually it was unsafe for the company, unsafe for our customers. And if that was the thing that was gonna get me terminated, okay, I'm fine with that. When I told my boss and ultimately told the CISO, instead of firing me, they actually said, wow, thank you so much for finding this. How about we do more work in this area? And that was actually kind of like my transition from a developer to becoming a true application security person, really actually having security as my primary focus of my job. And then at Bank of America, I had the opportunity to, take some of that application security work I was doing. And I got involved with this little startup super early named Fortify that was working on static analysis. And we were one of the very, very early customers. I, got the opportunity to work with Jacob West and Dr. Brian Chess, some of the things they were working on there. And, kind of hair club for men type story, liked the product so much. They were like, Flea, you have to come to California, help us build this thing. And that's how I, made my journey here to the West Coast. And then from there, just kind of, jumped around to a couple of other, security, other startups, et cetera. But probably the big turning point for me was moving away from just being somebody that analyzed security vulnerabilities or made products to help find security issues over to somebody that was actually having to live with security decisions. And I think that's one of the big like light bulb moments for me. It's like, hey, the things that I've built, I now have to actually live with those. If I tell somebody, hey, fix this issue or spend all this time working on this, that's now a issue that I have to live with. And that was also part of the motivation for me to, take some of my skills and move more towards, I guess, the pointy haired boss area of being a CISO, because we can actually have a lot of impact on not just the things we actually do as an IC, but the ability to actually build holistic, long-lived security programs so that we can actually have security be part of the DNA and culture of a company. And I got a couple of really, really great opportunities. I helped start the security team at Twilio along with the founder, Evan Cook. So we were like, hey, let's actually really make Twilio into a company that really believes that security should be part of its DNA. Got the call back with Brian Chest and then go back to NetSuite and actually kind of like do the same thing. And then, kind of like the rest is history, yada, yada, yada. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember for myself, it was a fascinating turning point going from the external perspective of finding flaws in other people's code or systems to being on the inside. I remember one of the first times we had a cross-site scripting vulnerability at Mozilla that was like publicly reported. I was like, oh my God, like how could this happen? How could this happen to me? What's everyone gonna think of me? Like, don't I know how to prevent cross-site scripting? And at that time, it was a team, and it's the element of systematically preventing issues at scale. And it was such a mind flip because technically it's super easy to prevent cross-site scripting, like conceptually, you just output in code, that's not hard. Doing that at organizational scale with all your developers, no one ever making a mistake or having the frameworks there to do it, that's like a whole nother ballgame. And that blew my mind. And that was some of the same things you're saying. It's really cool.
And I love you already kind of like honed in on that problem of like, hey, how do you actually do this at scale, right? Like, I think earlier in my career, I was definitely a frustrated security engineer. It was like, oh, why aren't developers doing this? Oh, developers are so dumb or blah, blah, blah. Not recognizing my part in that, right? Mm-hmm. Meaning that, hey, am I actually giving developers the right knowledge to do the right thing? Essentially, am I empowering developers to be better at security? Do I give them the right tools? Do I give them the right knowledge? Am I there really along on the journey with them? And do I have the right empathy to really allow them to actually move at development speed, but also being security conscious? And that was another huge light bulb moment for me. I think I really leaned into that heavily, in particular at Square, where it really is all about build. Like, what are the things that we can do as security practitioners or security organizations to build a safe ecosystem so developers can make the right choice, essentially the default choice. When you think about stuff like cross-site scripting, it is a fairly complex thing. It's not that developers can't understand it, it's that there's so many other things that you're wrestling with. Well, that is something that we understand really, really well as security practitioners. So let's actually put our engineering hats on, as you said, like help improve frameworks, help improve some of the other things so that developers are almost kind of like, you know, by default, they're safe. Like one of the things I try to strive for is 80% of the time, I want my developers to kind of just be making the right security choices without the security team being involved. If, you know, the long-term vision that I have for the industry that I would love to see become reality is that security teams essentially become smaller and smaller and look much different because developers themselves are actually doing security and they're doing it naturally. And it's through us actually giving them the right tools and building the right things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. That'd be a wonderful direction. And I think some of it is the way we see the world is almost influenced, you know, the differences between Silicon Valley companies, the speed at which they have to move, we're forced into this go fast, and then that heavy focus on engineering, which you kind of compare to a big bank in the Midwest is a little bit different. Like, we're going to stop everything and you're going to go through a big, heavy choke point. You can see that whole world flipped on its head, you know, by nature of the companies that we're at.
I just don't agree. But I would argue to say that even some of the quote unquote large banks actually could benefit from the same idea. Like, how do you actually just get developers more involved? We do know that, at least in our current thinking, and I definitely, you know, can riff on this a little bit more, that the amount of security practitioners in the world is just smaller than what we need. Like, even if you're at a large bank and you're in a large security team, you're always going to be outnumbered by the developers. So we need to figure out better ways to enable those developers to operate securely, even with a small security team or with even a non-existent security team. And so that means that even like a place like, you know, whatever large Midwest bank you can think of or East Coast bank, et cetera, you want to actually practice a lot of things that, you know, people here in Silicon Valley are doing, like a lot of those things around like, hey, developer enablement, how do you actually empower people? How do you turn security into a benefit as opposed to a cost, right? Like, so even at a bank, they want to move fast because there's money involved. They want to get more money. The more they can actually ship out new features, the more they can get more customers, et cetera. That's beneficial to a bank as well. So they have a lot of the same incentive to adopt some of these models of what modern security should look like.
Yep. Now, along those lines, are you seeing a shift in the CISO role itself? You're touching on some of these ideas like developer enablement, engineering driven. It seems like there's a few different flavors of CISO roles out there. What do you see as the direction forward there?
What do I see as the direction forward there? And hopefully it's mostly what I also want as a direction forward. A couple of things, I really do want to see more CISOs as business enablers as opposed to just a checkbox or just purely a compliance type role. Not saying that we actually don't need compliance and governance, but as a security team, they're expensive and it really should be adding value to the company. Even more so, ideally, the security team should be giving the company a competitive advantage. So what that means from a CISO standpoint is that the CISO should be really thinking about how do they accelerate teams? How do they allow teams to actually be more self-service? How do they allow teams in the company to really understand pragmatic risk-taking? Because I know, you know, there's actually tons and tons of vulnerabilities out there. There's tons of different things for security teams that can fix. Which are the ones that are actually really important? Like, we need more CISOs thinking about the idea that their role really is about helping a company understand and manage risk, not stopping risk, because we actually do need to take risk. The entire reason why we have VCs, et cetera, is this idea like, hey, we're going to place some bets. And those bets are things that other people haven't done. And let's actually figure out a way to actually control that risk in such a way that we can make a great product, make something that the consumers like, but it's also safe at the same time. And that's where the CISO comes in. Like, hey, how do I allow this company to make a great product while also keeping the company and the customer safe?
Yeah, it's very refreshing to hear that. Understanding pragmatic risk. I think that's really spot on. One of the challenges I've seen historically with the CISO role is the accountability of risk has been totally skewed. So they become accountable for every risk without the authority to impact the system. Yep. So naturally, if you're responsible for every problem, you're like, stop, don't do it. And I love what you're saying, which is, what if we empower teams to be able to take risks, which is also accepting responsibility and accountability there. But then suddenly you've got a whole different model and you can do all sorts of really cool things.
Oh, and it's phenomenal. Like I've definitely gotten the benefit from that, you know, at Gusto and as well as Square that has a similar model. And I believe that, you know, Twitter, and that was the model that you pushed there as well. This idea that the person who's actually kind of proposing these product things, they ultimately actually own the risk. And when you tell an individual that, hey, you're actually responsible for the outcome here, both good and bad, they actually make different decisions. And then your role as a CISO and security team is really about providing them that visibility. The analogy that I've used with other people, it's like when you were a broke college student, right? And, you know, you're spending your money at Pizza Hut and maybe the bar occasionally, and you're not paying attention to how much money you're spending. But maybe you get a copy of Quicken, like I'm old, so Quicken was my case, but maybe you're using Mint or whatever. And you see, oh, wait a second, this is where my money is going. Once you understand where these things happen, you actually make different decisions. But when the security team is labeled as the risk owners, you're actually decoupling that from the people making the decisions. One of the things actually I've talked to other people about is to some extent, there's things that security team just can't do from a risk standpoint. So we know that developers are moving at such a speed that even as your security team is set up in the traditional Gates model, that whatever you've reviewed, whatever you've assessed is gonna be different in production than what you actually looked at. Because you did that assessment a week ago, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, maybe even a month ago. And what lives in production now is like you're being released like several times a day. And so changes have already occurred. And so it's better to actually push that down to the people that are actually doing the changes and really making sure that they own it. And that has been a super healthy model. And what I found with this model of the product owners actually owning the risk, they actively bring in security. They actually want security to help them. I'm in a fortunate situation at Gusto where I actively have teams saying like, hey, Flea, give us more security help. Hey, Flea, can I have your security engineers come here and take a look at what we're doing? Hey, Flea, what do you think about this? And it's actually such a great feeling because it also is great for the morale of your security team. They no longer feel like they're the cops or the bad guys. They really are there as enablers, and they really feel more like a part of the engineering and the company building effort as opposed to the, you know, people slowing people down and the people that are actually being avoided, you know, in the cafeteria, et cetera. Speaking of avoidance, are we going to avoid this question about the matching shirts? I love the fact that we have great taste and hairstyles. Full disclosure, this shirt was a gift, so this is actually somebody else's great taste. We both thought it was
when you go to the martini bar, you feel you need a blue speckled shirt. It's and no hair. I think that's a given. I think anyone would do it. That's good stuff. Okay, so let's see. So we talked about the CISO as a business enabler. Love that. We talked about risk ownership in the teams. That makes tons of sense. You were touching a little bit on this engineering focus.
Yep.
Do you think there's a shift there? Is that where security teams are going to, taking on more engineering elements to empower teams? Or how do you like to structure your teams with the thinking of engineering?
I love builders. I love engineers. And part of the reason why it's so great is that engineering scales. It just does. Mm. Like doing a point in time assessment or somebody sitting down and saying like, hey, this is broken, blah, blah, blah. That doesn't scale. Like maybe you can do that assessment one time, but now that person has to come back to you again. If I build you a framework, if I build you something like a tokenization service, I build for you a better crypto storage system, then that's actually something that scales across all the engineers. You actually get to solve fundamental problems that everybody in the company begins to benefit from. And that's actually one of the advantages of actually adding engineers to your team. My team at Gusto is primarily, you know, engineers. You know, most of them can actually write code. They don't necessarily actually write code day to day. Definitely have a team that literally is kind of their primary function. Same thing at Square, same thing at Twitter. We're seeing more and more of these modern teams that are like, hey, wait a second, there's so much power in software. Let's use that. One of the other great things is that, you know, we used to think of security as actually just being kind of like just a policy type team and a policy type function, like, hey, we're going to write a bunch of guidelines. How many times do you actually see someone actually read those policies? It's all fair and good, and they might actually read the policies, but if you turn those policies into code, you know you're getting your way. And that actually turns the policy into something that's actually real and not just a checkbox that you show to auditors. You can actually say, hey, not only is this our policy, but here it is in code. Here's how it works. Here's how we actually audit it. Here's how we actually make sure that it actually, you know, works, et cetera. It's just a much more scalable fashion The other great thing is that you can essentially steal from other teams. You know, there is kind of that quote unquote hiring gap. I still have issues with that. But by bringing in engineers, they don't have to necessarily be a security expert to actually contribute to security. Because if you have other, you know, security experts within your team, they can help write designs for the kind of software that we want to see. They can help actually improve frameworks. They can help, you know, your DevOps team actually deploy into AWS in a safe way, a scalable way, et cetera. So that's actually one of the things, you know, one of the things that engineers actually just bring as value there. The other things that engineers in general really do have the notion and opinion that their job is to build and find yes. And that's actually one of the things that I think more and more security teams need to have. If you have a security team or you work with a security team where their mantra is not find yes, fire them. You have to have a security team that really wants to be creative about finding solutions to security problems that aren't just saying, no, you can't do that. Because saying, no, you can't do that doesn't scale. It also doesn't work and it doesn't help the business and it doesn't bring delight to our customers.
Yeah, that was something that was successful for me as well at Twitter for sure. Having a portion of the organization be a security engineering team, which was largely comprised of developers that wanted to build solutions for a security like feature or in the vein of security. And just like you said, that helped a ton for hiring, mostly even internal transfers.
Oh, yeah.
And that's like magic because you get somebody who already knows exactly how the product works that you're securing. They know the norms, they know the people. You build goodwill real quick with that. And I think there's certainly a desire to teach everyone code to some level. But I would also say at the same time, we had the pure policy teams. We had the consultative assessment type teams. But the blend of all of them gave you this just like rock star team. And that was really cool.
It's a superpower. I love engineers that are actually writing code. But I do probably the bigger thing actually I like to see and what I want my teams to have is builders. And I love you actually pointed out something about policy. Policy is building. And you can actually be a builder by actually writing policy and writing policy that's actually right size for your company. You know, one of my philosophy at Gusto is like, yeah, we don't want quote unquote aspirational policies. And we see that all the time where a company is like, yeah, we wrote our security policy. Here's all the things that we're, you know, that we do, et cetera. But when you actually go look underneath the hood, it actually isn't there. They don't actually do that. For me, it's preferable to have really great builders who are like saying, hey, I'm going to write the policy that reflects exactly what we have. And then start thinking about, well, how do I actually construct a framework for the company that allows us to actually get to that next level, that addresses some of those gaps we actually might see there. And that's where that build mentality comes in. So you don't necessarily have to be somebody that actually writes code to be a builder. It's almost like a state of mind to actually be an engineer. When I think engineer, I think somebody who wants to solve problems. They want to be creative and they want to solve problems. So it's not just about writing software.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure, for sure. So you mentioned something that is a really great interest of mine, I believe of yours as well, but you mentioned hiring and security. And Matt, wow, I mean, I've seen really bad hiring practices at places, that's for sure. There's so many ways to do this wrong. And I've seen also lots of glimmers of hope of people doing it better. But I mean, amazing teams are comprised of amazing people, which come from, you know, diverse skills, diverse backgrounds, diverse walks of life. How do you build that great team? What challenges are you seeing in hiring and how are you tackling those?
I think one is literally just having an open mind and also remembering where we as security practitioners came from. Like I'm definitely old enough that I pre-exist certifications. I pre-exist being able to go to college for these various things. How I learned and got into security, obviously, at least in the 80s and 90s was a traditional path. But it's a non-traditional path now, meaning that, yes, I got started by, you know, tinkering and breaking into stuff. And that's what we love about security and quote unquote hackers. But also recognizing what that means was like, hey, wait a second. I was getting skill set that had nothing to do with a certification or whatever classes I went to, or even like the university that I went to. So we should be much more open-minded about how we are looking to hire. One of the things I like doing is actually really looking for certain kind of attributes of a person as opposed to a particular skill set. And what I mean with that, like, yes, you might know how to use Splunk, but do you actually really understand what it means to be a threat hunter? Meaning that you actually really know what it means to take a brand new system, something you haven't seen before, and think about, hey, how would I do forensics here? Or take a protocol you haven't even heard of. Like, hey, how would I analyze this protocol and break into that? So those are actually some of the things you have to think about from an interview standpoint. It's actually breaking out our interview process to look more and more about the attributes that we actually want to see in an individual, as opposed to the specific tool set that they may or may not know. One is that tool sets change all the time. Like the stuff that I, was familiar with in the 90s doesn't even exist anymore, right? Like, I probably nobody in your calls, like, you remember Satan or some of the other, like, old school tools, et cetera. Mm-hmm. The other big thing is actually making sure that we are very open-minded in our network and looking far, broad, and wide, and recognizing some of the people that can do there. Like, there is a young lady I love to brag about all the time. Her name is Alexander Nassar. She's a program manager now, a security program manager. When I met her at NetSuite, she actually just worked at the front desk, but she had phenomenal skills with actually, one, being organized and also working with people. She was probably one of my strongest team members because she was able to go and communicate to engineers and actually get them to actually change behavior. So it's really actually, I wanted to focus on that attribute and that skill set that I needed, as opposed to whether or not she actually needed security. The other thing that I've learned is that once you start having a diverse team, it actually makes it even easier to have a diverse team, because other people are then like, oh, wait a second. I come to join this team. There's actually people that look like me. I actually feel comfortable there, and I feel like I won't have an imposter syndrome, or I feel like this will be a team that's actually open to the thing that I bring here. I think one of the other important things for us to do as hiring managers is to also dismiss some of the stereotypes we have about what a security person looks like. I definitely do not look like what most people think of as quote unquote a hacker. Even though, I definitely have my own past and there's tools and things like that I've built, but I don't have a mohawk. Actually, I don't have hair. In case it's not obvious from the webcam, this isn't a trick. I am black. I'm not white. It's like all these other things that people think of as stereotypes, we just have to toss those out and toss out the idea that, hey, you have to have certain credentials. You have to have this kind of education. One of the strongest engineers that I've ever worked with, pretty sure he does not have a college degree. I'm not even sure if he even graduated high school, but he is like one of my role models. He's just phenomenal. And it's because he really has the aptitude, the attributes, and the skill set. And that's actually part of the reason why I also kind of think that the idea that our security hiring challenges are pipeline related, I disagree with that. It's just that we're not being creative enough. We're not actually being thoughtful enough about how we actually examine candidates and how we're actually interviewing and actually building these teams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's spot on. There's some amazing people I've worked with, and their backgrounds have all been very, very different than what you would put down on a stereotypical, like, this is a great background. One thing that I find very interesting, and I kind of urge everyone to this, if you have someone wonderful you work with and you get a chance to talk about, what they've done in life, you might find what I found, which is that they have shown success in weird and unusual situations. Like, somebody I worked with was just amazing. And I believe he had a summer job overseeing like a farm, and he is not a farmer. And he was successful. Like, this ability to be thrown into a crazy unique situation, figure out how to be successful and then execute, is a really powerful skill in security. And to your point, we have to look at this a little bit different to find those attributes that really matter and throw out the ones that are stereotypical and hold us back.
And the companies that are doing that already have a superpower, and they're out competing everybody else because they're actually just draw in talent from so many different places and to get so many different views. And it's just so many things that actually help improve products. A great example is some of the things actually going on now that we're actually seeing out in the ecosystem. So when we think about some of the things like privacy concerns or things like that, privacy impacts people in different ways. And by having more diversity in your team, you actually get more perspectives about actually how to look at your product, how to actually make that improved, et cetera. And so it's just super, super important. And ultimately, you actually end up with a better product, ideally a better team, and hopefully a happy, shiny, better life, et cetera.
Yes. So we have a few more topics we're going to hit. Those of you listening live, if you have questions about stuff we talked about already, if you have some things you want to pepper Flea with, throw them in Q&A. We'll get to a few of them as time permits. So don't forget to do that. So Flea, I want to pick your mind here about two different opposing forces that I'm hearing. I'm hearing the business enabling CISO, and I'm also hearing the engineering focused security team. So how do you, in that middle spot as the CISO balance technical hands-on versus hands-off managerial?
I'm definitely guilty of this, meaning that as a former practitioner, it is hard not to get your hands dirty again. Like that, there's this part of your brain that, you know, diving in, opening up a terminal, doing something, it just makes it tingle. And it's hard not to want to do that. The better thing to do, though, is to write more. And this is actually a weakness that I had. One of me to write more is actually explain your philosophy to your team. Help them actually understand why you want to have a certain approach, and then get comfortable being uncomfortable. Because the discomfort that's going to come to you is that they're not going to do everything exactly like you want. You want to give them the right tools and effectively get out of the way. But also recognize that your job as a CISO is to kind of set the direction, the path, and hold your team accountable to actually hitting those targets. I'm a huge fan of actually just being data-driven. So if you're building things from a security standpoint, it's like, hey, what does the success criteria actually look like? Hey, we're building out a new capability. Okay, hey, now we have this new capability. So for example, maybe you have a modern kind of like detection and response team. Like, okay, well, one of the things your detection and response team is focused on doing is like building out detective capabilities. So, you know, you tell the team like, hey, I want to see this in the world. I want to see this kind of capability, and I want to see some way to actually verify and check that. Like I said, it's tempting to actually put your hands back on it yourself, but it's actually better if you'd actually really set up what the success criteria is, or rather what the actual objective is, and then actually how do you actually want to measure that? And that's actually probably a more important thing for us to actually do as CISOs. It's an important skill just in general in this leadership type role. It's like figuring out how do you actually measure success? And that's one of the areas that actually come from a balance standpoint. When it comes to like having a servant oriented type security team, meaning your security team there is to provide a service to the rest of the company. So also figure out like, hey, does the company actually like what you're doing? Like you really do. You actually want to think about things like quote unquote NPS. It's like, hey, are your customers satisfied? Do you tell your customers that they are actually okay to fire you? And I know it sounds somewhat controversial, but if your security team feels like they can be quote unquote fired, then it actually makes sure that their incentives are aligned with the customers, that can really deliver to them actual value there. There's definitely some nuance there, right? Because as a security team, you actually have multiple customers. There's obviously the product team that's actually one of your customers, but also the rest of the C-suite, and as well as the board of directors are also a customer, and they do have different concerns. Not all of them should fire you, or at least they all shouldn't fire you all at the same time. But it does mean you actually have the right incentive to actually really do the job of security. So.
That customer-oriented mindset is really great, and then that flips the whole thing on your head. Like this, of course you can't be a security team that says no. That doesn't achieve value for the business. That's not customer-oriented. I think being the champion of those things, and I love how you mentioned, you know, net promoter score. Those kinds of things, like just asking other parts of the business, like what are the best ways for us to help us? What are the biggest security things you're concerned about? Those are really powerful discussions, I found for sure.
Oh, like one of the core values we have at guest owned security teams is this idea of lovable security. That was actually stolen from Alexandra Nassar. When we're actually doing some of the stuff at NetSuite, she's like, we had this thing that we call the security rainbow, which is kind of how we communicated to the company around security. And she's like, hey, what about lovable? Security needs to be lovable. It needs to be a team that other people want to approach, that they adore, that they want to be engaged with, et cetera.
Wow. I like that. That's really cool. All right. Let's still have a few topics, but let's bring in one of these questions. All right. So question from our live audience. How do you see the consumerization of security improve in a post-COVID world? Or do you think it improves?
I do think that it is going to improve. And I think I'm not a huge fan of this avenue for security actually getting the kind of attention that it's probably needed for a while. But I do think a lot more people within your company and outside of companies are now understanding a little bit more about what it means to prepare for kind of like these black swan events and the value of that. So, you know, at Gusto, you know, we're in a fortunate position that we did spend a lot of time thinking about business continuity, thinking about disaster recovery, thinking about what it means to have, a remote workforce, et cetera. So even though it wasn't something that we thought we were going to be using this year, it turned out, hey, all that preparation work was useful for this Black Swan event. And people inside the company, now they're like, oh, wow, all those things that the security team was talking to me about, the questions they were asking about critical systems, et cetera, it all makes sense now, because now I can have access to all these various things. And we see that at other companies as well. I think some of the other things that you're seeing is some of the more interesting approaches towards endpoint security and how to actually do that. Like, what are the things that, you know, teams and companies should be concerned about? Because now we have tons and tons of people operating on networks that are not controlled by the company. Like, yes, you might be connecting via VPN, but you're still on your home Wi-Fi. What happens when you're disconnected? What are you actually doing on your laptop? As our workforce exists today, more and more people are treating their company assets as a hybrid asset. And what I mean by that, they use it both for personal and business use. So how do we actually make that safe? And I think a lot of people are really experiencing the value that the security team is actually bringing there to help them actually do things like that. So we know that, for example, somebody might be using their laptop and maybe they're in G Suite or something like that. So, oh, well, what are tools we can actually roll out to make G Suite safer? Are there things we can actually do to make, you know, email safer? Are there things we can actually do to make things like document sharing safer, et cetera? In particular, now that people have in their mindset that their machine is a hybrid machine. Like, you know, and I think you probably have already, you may have made this mistake in the past yourself. The classic
I've made
thing, many. Okay, yeah. So like the classic thing, for example, in G Suite is I have your email address and I'm writing a document, right? And I have, you know, michaelcoates@gmail.com because we've exchanged, you know, emails personally or something like that. And now I'm writing a sensitive document and I'm sharing it with people. And instead of like michaelcoates at your business address, I accidentally send it to the wrong address. Are there protections we can do? And we should expect people to make more of those kind of mistakes. Obviously, we've already seen it in the past. Even more so now than this hybrid model of where, like, hey, my work computer is my personal computer. Sometimes my personal computer is my work computer. So those are also things that I think that are really, really impacting things that in COVID is kind of exposing that, because now we have people doing this at least 8 hours a day where they're at home using their personal their personal computing device or their business computing device in this hybrid model.
Yeah, the cloud reality and that misalignment of work and personal access and resources. I saw that a fair amount at Twitter and saw it coming. And that was before, you know, this new COVID reality. And you're right. I think it's increasing even more. That example you mentioned in particular, certainly an area that I know well also, like something Altitude focuses on extensively, that and variations.
One of the things that I've seen that comes across so frequently in the document sharing scenarios, in particular, is like dealing with board members.
Yep. Board decks, board members, all the time.
Oh, yeah. I know that we have more questions. I don't want to, you know, rattle on too long. You know, I'm from the South, so I can talk forever. So.
Yep. No, I like it. I mean, you put us in a bar, you give us some drinks, you let us talk security. We're going to keep going. Yeah. okay, let's see. We'll mix them back and forth here. I've got a quick question for you, which is, what should people be reading or following for security? Do you have a favorite Twitter account, book, website? I don't know, anything.
Yes, so several. I have several. There actually is a new website / newsletter / Twitter account that I actually have gotten a lot of value out of. It's called TLDRSec.
Yep.
I love it just because it does a really good job of capturing you know, new innovative security engineering work, like true security engineering work. It focuses a lot on building tools that you can actually utilize in your day-to-day. It does a really good job actually also just digesting that information. So it's run by a gentleman, Dr. Clint Gibbler, and he spent a lot of time actually just going to conferences and actually really actually reading through and pouring through some papers and just various different announcements about what other people are actually working on. If I can only recommend one thing for people to follow just across the board, it'd be TLDRSec. I'm a huge fan of a couple of blogs. You know, obviously I'm biased. I still love Square's blog. I think that Square actually does a really good job of actually promoting some good engineering and security things there. Segment has a phenomenal blog. They benefited from stealing a lot of great hires, in particular for their security team. I'm still angry at them for that, but love the work that they're doing over there. You know, I can never say enough things about Netflix and their open source blog and the things that, you know, Jason Chan has actually been doing there, pushing the boundaries on security. If it comes to books, probably one of the books I recommend the most is Security Engineering. And it's free. Like, you know, obviously you can go and buy it on Amazon, but you can also just Google it, and the book is there. And you can actually just download the chapters. It actually is digestible, and it actually, obviously security is a vast field. And there's so many different things and different, you know, portions of that. And I think that book actually really captures all of it in a way that's actually digestible, even for somebody actually early in their security journey. Right? Mm-hmm. It's one of my favorite books to recommend to people. So I always, you know, try to give a shout out for that as well.
Awesome. I will track those links down and we'll put them below the show recording for those of you listening. Those are awesome. And I second the TLDR sec for sure. I came across that one as well. Talked with him at right before RSA, and it's awesome. It's a good one to subscribe to. All right, two remaining items here. Let's see, let's work in another question from our audience. How do you think about connecting product security with the user in the future and partnering with your users to achieve better security for them and your product?
Oh, I love this topic because it goes back to the whole lovable security thing. I would love to see more and more companies, one, actually think about their security UX. Like, what is the actual user experience for the security controls they put in place? So can you make 2FA more palatable? I mean, like, obviously, I'm a huge Duo security fan. I think they really actually nailed that. I pretty much everything Doug Song touches is gold. But, you know, that's a good example of somebody who actually was really thinking about the experience of security and how it actually impacts end users. And you're in this scenario now where people are actually delighted with Duo. And they're like, hey, like, I want more Duo because it's so easy to use and I feel safe. Because it actually turns out that users want security. They just don't want obnoxious security. They don't want something that can be overly complex, something that can be extremely disruptive, et cetera. You know, also, I like to think about what are some of the things that we'd like to have as security practitioners that maybe an end user would. And I think a lot of you see this a lot now in products now, like the classic things like, hey, you know, as a security practitioner, I do care when there are significant changes made to an administrative account or, you know, and those kind of things. And so like, hey, well, we should probably be exposing that to end users as well. I think a lot of people are probably familiar with actually maybe seeing this now in Google, where Google will say like, hey, we saw you log in from this device, or you can even go and check in your Gmail, like, hey, where was the last login activity? The more we can actually present some of this telemetry to end users in a way they understand, the better. It's still a long journey for us in the security world to actually get better at that. There's a lot of people actually thinking about this concept of user-focused security. And so I think it's actually a really, really interesting avenue, and I would love to get more people involved in that, because it's also one of those areas where we can actually just bring in more and more people into security. You don't have to be a hacker to understand that, hey, you know, a 120 character password is probably difficult for a lot of people to remember. You don't need to be a hacker to actually be able to do that, but you can actually, you know, help people actually develop really, really innovative designs, things that are actually a lot more humane. And I think it's the thing we all often forget about in security. We often forget that our job here is that we're actually trying to protect and enable humans. And so we have to make sure that we always think about the human that is at the end of that experience.
Yep.
I can go on this topic for hours. I love it.
It's a good one. Security usability is fascinating. I would say when I joined Mozilla and we started thinking about some of the elements in Firefox, security elements that were facing users, like that was a big smack in the face. Like, you know, this notion of showing someone like there's mixed content on this page. Do you want to continue? Like, wait, what does that mean? Like, we know what that means if we think for a sec, but like, you know, regular old users are just trying to shop, you know, buy something, whatever. Like, they don't know what that means. And they're going to say continue because I need to buy a sandwich or whatever they're doing.
Yeah.
And it's really fascinating. Like, well, how do we do something that helps them understand and make a decision? And the classic fail I've seen is, wait, are we punting on something that we don't want to deal with to give it to the user and say, oh, user choice? It's not user choice if the user doesn't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Like, that's just failure on our side. And that's hard. That's really hard. All right. So last question for you. Based on everything you've seen, what advice would you give to someone that wants to get into security? Maybe they're at their beginning of this potential career. Maybe they're going to make a transition from something else. And maybe one day they want to be a CISO. What's your advice to them?
I always feel like there should be a support group for people who think they want to be a CISO. I love being a CISO. I love the people I get to work with. I love my team and all things that you've brought to me. But it's definitely a choice. And there are definitely other ways and other enjoyable things as a security career. Happy to talk to anybody who wants to know about my journey as a CISO, the positives and the negatives, et cetera. With regards to actually just getting started in the industry, recognize that one is that there are tons of resources available for you to actually go and learn from. One of the things I do always recommend is learn to program. Even learning just how to make a basic web app teaches you so much about a lot of things that we actually think about in modern security, that having that fundamental knowledge there just almost gives you a superpower over other people that may have had, you know, the quote unquote CISSP type route, et cetera. Like being able to actually build and understand the underlying technology just gives you a superpower immediately. Also recognizing that there are multiple avenues into security. You don't have to just be a hacker. You can actually be a builder. You can actually think about how do you build tools? How do you actually add value from that standpoint? Definitely take advantage of, you know, some of the easy, you know, resources like OWASP. Obviously you're familiar with that. But OWASP is a really, really good resource to actually go and learn some really, really basic things. If you are interested in some of the hacking stuff, I'm a huge fan of Pentester Labs, and they actually have some really, really good online materials, good online training there. Some free, some paid. That's actually another good resource. Also, reach out to the network. There has been I guess maybe this image of security people being jerks. We're not all jerks. And I love to help people learn. I love to help them. And I got to benefit myself from other people actually reaching out to me and helping me actually learn on my journey. When I got started in security, and I'm pretty sure it's the same thing for you, Michael, security was all about the community and actually helping each other, everybody improving, sharing knowledge about something that you found with somebody else. That DNA is still there. And when you actually reach out and you say, hey, I want to learn something, there generally will be somebody who's actually willing to say, oh yeah, I'll teach you that. I'll show you at least how I do it. And I'll show you the little bit of knowledge that I have there. Probably the final big thing is embrace failure and don't give up. Because it can be hard. Like learning some of the first things will take a little bit of grit, and you won't get it immediately. You might fail. It might seem complicated, but there's going to come a moment where it just kind of clicks for you, and that you'll be able to actually move forward and actually build from there. And actually, I lied. I do have one other problem, which is something that I've wrestled with actually trying to explain to other people. There actually aren't a lot of shortcuts to learning security. And what I mean by that is I've definitely had people who've asked me, it's like, hey, how do you know this thing? How do I learn to do, you know, this kind of architecture? How do I learn? And there isn't something I can actually tell you that's going to be 30 minutes. I can tell you tons of things that actually, you know, you build all these skills over, you know, months, years, et cetera. And it's really about the synthesis of all the various small experiences that you've had that actually lead you to actually being a really, really great security practitioner.
Yep. Yep, I agree. Yeah, there's certainly an element of hard work and grit getting in there, figuring things out. That's for sure.
Embrace the grind, man. Embrace the grind.
Yep. Awesome. This has been wonderful. Philippe, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Thank you to everyone who joined us for this live. Pretty awesome to have you here, taking a moment out of your day to join us in this nice place in Barcelona. And thank you to the people that are watching this recording in the future. But this was Flea, who you're with for this last 45 minutes and all his wonderful information. I'm Michael Coates. And this was brought to you by Altitude Networks. If data security in the cloud is something you are thinking about, check us out. And we have more CISO to CISO webcasts coming. So do follow our LinkedIn page or Twitter, as we'll announce them there. Other great minds that will be on here sharing their thoughts. But again, thanks so much, Flea, and thanks everyone for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.